hello out there, Pinky Podsters. Did you miss me?
What's that? You didn't even know I wasn't making episodes for a while? Okay, whatever. I'm not hurt. I'm fine. This is fine. No, I'm not. Merry Christmas! Christmas! Or Happy Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Yule, you know, whatever else you're doing. I've been on a mental break, a lazy break. No, lazy's not a good word. Just a break. But I couldn't resist coming back for a little Christmas special. And fittingly, there are some snowflakes. I'm seeing them out my window. And within the next 24 to 36 hours, I think we could have upwards of 7 inches here in Seattle. Huh. It messes with me trying to go to work and make money, but what am I going to do? I would rather not be on the icy side streets. We're just not prepared for it here. But it's fun. It's fun to walk around in, so I will probably do that tomorrow. I will likely wake up to a blanket of snow, which is always beautiful early in the morning. So yay me for my cat waking me up stupid early, or me just waking up at this point, because at least I get to see that. What are you guys doing for the holidays? Anything fun? Anything cool? And for those of you who this is a very hard time, I'm sending out hugs, vibes, comfort. And I hope that you'll make it through this. Stay with us. As for today's subject, though, shall we just get right to it? And I apologize if you hear stuff in the background, like a fan or anything. If you've been with me since the beginning, you know that my apartment has long had these HVAC issues, and quite often in the winter when windows are closed up and everything. And it's like this rattling, droning thing, mostly from some vent or over, you know, the stuff I can't see, right, in the ceiling, in the bathroom. So the fix is to turn on my microwave fan, which of course then I can still hear that, but I can put it on low. It's not too bad. It's better than the rattling, like something is just vibrating my ceiling all day, which wants to make me go, wee, wee, wee. Remember that? Yeah, if you've been here the whole time, you remember that. So I apologize. There's really not much I can do about it. I might be moving out of here in the spring. We shall see. We shall see. Have no idea what those acoustics will be, but we shall see. To the subject now, though, without further ado. You've probably heard of Krampus, the antithesis of Santa. And it's a growing phenomenon, shall we say, the popularity and the interests in Krampus. Year after year, I see more and more of it. And who doesn't like a good Krampus? I mean, there's great Krampus movies. I think one of the best ones I saw was probably Danish, although I couldn't tell you the name of it at this point. I'm really sorry. But yes, I've also seen that slightly cheesy, but also still cool and has some interesting, you know, creepy moments, Krampus film. Have you seen it? Check it out. But the one I'm going to recommend to you that you really should give it a try is called Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale. And stay through the credits, because you know how sometimes the end of a film can almost blow everything that went before, like, oh, that's such a disappointing ending to what was such a great film. The ending of this actually is what seals it up in a pretty and perfect little bow. And if you've watched it, you know what I'm talking about. You're welcome. Go find it. I think you can probably find it for free right now on a few channels. But it's time to give the so-called fairer sex her due. Yes? Have you heard of Frau Puchta? Most of you probably haven't, especially if you're in America. She is sometimes known as the Christmas witch or goddess. She's well known in the Alps of South Germany and Austria. Lind Redich, author of The Old Magic of Christmas, which I think I'm so going to have to purchase, yeah, look it up, states that our Frau was also known as Berchta, Bertha, and has been called Spinnstubenfrau, which is a spinning room lady. She's often shown with an iron nose, like literally made out of iron. It's beaked, you know, like a bird. She's dressed in rags. She might carry a cane, and she looks kind of like a decrepit crone, basically, you know, which is very common in some of these tales. But do not underestimate her. She's packing, you guys. She's packing. There's a long knife under her skirts. Now, some say she also has similarities with the goddess Frigga, or Holda. She is said to wander through Hohensalzburg Fortress at night. And they both love to spin, and they're like goddesses of spinning and domestic cleanliness, among other things. There is a legend that states you should have all of your flax spun by the 12th night, which is January 6th. Quote, "For when Christmas is over, it would be time to set up the big upright loom, at which time you must have enough thread to start your weaving." So what happens if you don't? You just don't like spinning? Well, in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, you'll hear tales of the Frau trampling or setting fire to your half-spun fibers. She'll just destroy what you did manage to do. And if you're, say, also a really shitty housekeeper, and who hasn't had those times, and you also don't leave her an offering of a bowl of porridge, oh, nothing much. She'll just disembowel you in your bed and fill your body with rocks and straw. No big deal. Anybody see that porridge? You got some porridge? Oh, yeah, and bring me that vacuum. Now, of course, these sound like, as is often the case, tales to scare less industrious people, shall we say, into doing their work. You know, like, oh, you're lazy and shiftless and you're good for nothing, and here the Frau is going to cut out your guts. Yeah, because that's a real great way to get people to do stuff. But, you know, especially if they believe it, it is a good way. But how sad that you feel you have to punish people to get them to do just daily chores. There are other legends, however. She's also associated with the Wild Hunt. Now, Witcher fans in particular, Witcher 3, which, hey, hello, new update and PS5 upgrade. Yo! Yeah, you betcha I started playing it again for like the 8th or 9th time. I've lost track. I haven't gotten far enough yet to see, like, apparently there is one new quest. I don't know if it's very big, but visually it does look beautiful. And there already were some armor additions, and I found like some extra note from Yennefer. Make sure you look around, because it would have been easy to miss. There's this letter on the table when you first go to see Ymir. If you know, you know. Okay, I won't give it all away. Where was I? Yes, so, but you know the Wild Hunt from that if you've played the game, and you might know it from other stories, because it's in several. But imagine a ghostly or supernatural leader who has a group of hounds and or servants who fly through the cold night sky. The wind's howling. Sometimes it's elves, as in the game. They are elves in the game. That's something for another time, perhaps. Maybe it should have its own... Maybe the Wild Hunt should be its own entire episode. I don't, you know, because it's kind of fascinating. But our Frau would also fly through the night sky with her army of lost souls, such as the frightening Perchten. These are her servants, and they look a lot like little Krampuses. Krampuses? Krampi? I kind of like that. Hey, help me out here, I got a Krampi. Krampus, now I can't say it. Krampus rides on St. Nicholas Eve, while Perchten are usually around Epiphany and the last three Thursdays before Christmas. Those are known as Birched Nights, aka Knocking Nights. So January 6th is Epiphany, and St. Nicholas Night is December 5th, just so you know. And also in her army are the souls of unbaptized children. So now you start getting that whole Christian idea, particularly in times past, of being damned if you're not baptized or not buried in sacred ground, etc., etc. Again, if you've been with me, these have been mentioned in other podcast episodes. This has been mentioned. Now, if you hear wind and thunder roaring through the mountains on Birchtel nights, I think I said that wrong before, Birchtel nights, that's Frau Perchta leading her wild hunt. And it's bad luck to those who hear her, or even just hear the wind possibly. So I guess just stay inside and soundproof your house. But she also has quite the duality. Another of her names is Holly, H-O-L-L-E, which is shining or bright. So you have this, shall we say, evil, ugly Frau, and you also have the very pretty Perchten, who could run into... You could run into either... Oh, read my own writing here. Would it be an episode if I wasn't, you know, just messing it up? You might run into Perchtenlauf or Perchten... I have no idea what I wrote. Basically, you're going to run into one or the other. I honestly have no idea what that is I just wrote. We're going to leave that in there because, yeah, it's so me. Now, those are the notes that I wrote down. Those are the notes that I wrote down because I preferred to just go to some websites who have already written out wonderful explanations of this. And the first website I had gone to is hexenkund.com. H-E-X-E-N-K-U-N-D-E.com. Because they talk about the wild hunt. The wild hunt is a widely distributed mythical event across Europe and beyond. In its alpine variant, the mythological deity Perchta has been historically equated to mythological deities such as Diana and Artemis, both of them functioning as a mistress of animals and the hunt. This has got a lot of footnotes, y'all. They've got them all in parentheticals here, which I'm not going to read out. I will put a link to this website in the show notes because they've studied this. According to an Italian historian, Carlo Ginzburg, the myth of the wild hunt promotes fertility in nature and on your land, as well as good luck for the upcoming new year, which is very different than how we've seen it. There's different stories about the wild hunt, which is why I wanted to read this to you. In addition, other notable scholars have argued that female mythological characters such as Perchta, Artemis, and Diana resemble a very widespread myth of a guardian of wild game and of nature, which is often found and recorded among North Eurasian hunting cultures. But the problem is that such common similarities cannot propose a historical connection between Perchta, Artemis, and Diana, with the many variants of the master of game motif among indigenous Siberian hunters. I mean, this is pretty deep. They posit that Perchta was a venerated mythological character, and that her wild hunt emphasizes the relationship of humans to animals and the wild. Now you have other people such as Grimm, who suspected that Frau Perchta had the rank of a minor deity, but then was transitioned into a witch-like figure after Christianization. And they even cite a source, Grimm, 1835, page 17. There's a medieval text, Thesaurus Pauperum, for instance, that banned the cult of Frau Perchta in Bavaria in the year 1468. The cultic worship of Perchta was clearly condemned by Christian authorities at that time. The text mentions the importance of its followers to leave food and drink for Frau Perchta in exchange for wealth and abundance. The same practice was condemned by Thomas Ebendorfer von Hasselbach in De Dissim Praeceptis, and this is 1439. Later canonical and church documents characterize Frau Perchta as synonymous with other leading female spirits such as Holda, so there's that again, Diana, Herodias, Richella, and Abundia, like abundance. They're talking about how a lot of the values and things expressed by them derive from ideas regarding divine forces of fertility. Now, there's also mentioned here that Perchta herself was declared to be a celestial sky queen, or Himmelskönigin, I know I said that wrong, in German. I practiced some of the other pronunciations, but I didn't know this one. Himmelsko, with an umlaut, N-I-G-I-N. Himmelskönigin. This is attested to in a text called Ume Fratres Rudolfi den Confession Discretion, dating back to 1235 and 1250, so 13th century. The word Percht was first mentioned in 11th century Monsieur Glossen, hereby regarding processions that take place around the time of Epiphany rather than an actual deity. So, apparently first mentioned in Monsieur Glossen as an event instead of a person. They go on to say that, as we now know, Perchta was a mythological character of tremendous importance in the Austro-Bavarian cultural sphere and beyond. There is a text all the way back to 783 entitled Synode zu Lüftene, and it mentions a so-called Rieslaufen, where masquerades with people wearing animal hides and masks took place, which reminds me of, you guys, what is the Welsh one? I know, I probably, what is that one? Hang on. Here we go. I had to look it up because I knew I was not going to remember it precisely correctly. Mari Lwyd, or Lwyd. That's the one. It sounds very much like that. You know, you may have seen it where they're wearing the horse skull and the cape and stuff. And it's also something that happens around Christmas. Ooh, bookmark that, yeah? It also mentions food offerings placed in honor of Perchta's hunt. There was so basically this all shows that they did have some belief in a celestial deity that leads a hunt, along with a hunter, Berchtold. Southern Germanic tribes might have engaged in elk masquerades throughout midwinter, and in particular during New Year's. And here's another one I'm sure I can't pronounce. Hirschmaskeraden. So from archaeological records, there were two Alemannic runic artifacts from southern Germany that might be interesting in this context. The first artifact is a Nordendorf Fibulae, which was found north of Augsburg along Lecht River at an Alemannic cemetery. The Fibulae contains the runic inscription, Little Baron Elk. Another artifact is a so-called Fjorsenbuckle from the Algal region. The artifact bears the runic inscription, Egil an the Elrun. I can't pronounce the rest, I'm sorry, which is translated to mean elk, stag, and damned the stags. This is a really deep article, y'all. I'm definitely going to link it. Other little factoids. Burchard, Bishop of Worms, and Bishop of Rouen also condemned the practice of dressing up as stags. Well, of course not. They didn't like any of that, I'm sure. And they go on to talk about elks and everything else. But here's another thing I want to touch on. In order to understand Perchta and her wild hunt, it might be useful to look at the wild hunt processions and animal masquerades from a pan-European perspective. There are several sub-variants of Perchta's myth and appearance. For instance, Perchta appeared as a wild wood woman who needed help in repairing her broken wagon and or a plow. So during a storm, the wagon of the wild huntress takes damage and the lightning strikes turn to gold. The storm is a harbinger of unborn spirits awaiting their journey back to birth and finally life. Grimm even mentions that Perchta journeys the landscape on a wagon and asks farmers to repair the wagon. She turns their wood dust into gold as a currency. And behind her is a horde of unborn human souls, the Furious Horde. The carpenter repairs the plow in order for Perchta to carry over the crying unborn souls, sometimes across a river. basically, that's actually a good thing, right? That's kind of like Charon, the ferryman. I mean, she's actually performing a good function in this respect. And that's true, I think, of other mentions of so-called wild hunts, or they might not call it that. They might call them processions. And people, of course, might be afraid of ghosts or unborn souls, but at the heart, it might actually be something good, and things tend to get changed over time with different cultures and religions and Christianity, etc. In another place, there was a widespread belief that on this night, souls from soon-to-be-born children are thrown down from the sky, where the unborn souls during the wild hunt must pass through. Just some crazy stuff. It's actually kind of scary in some ways, but maybe not so bad. I think that one was just a little bit difficult to read, so I now have another page, mythology.net. I'll give their little summary of what is the wild hunt. It's a well-known folk myth of a ghostly leader and a group of hunters and hounds flying through the cold night sky, accompanied by sounds of the howling wind. I think that's the one that I wrote down. The supernatural hunters are recounted as either the dead, elves, or in some instances, fairy. That's what I first knew them as, Celtic folklore. In the northern tradition, the wild hunt was synonymous with great winter storms or changes of season. And then you'll see that in The Witcher 3, The Wild Hunt, because they're always accompanied by snow and cold. You know they're approaching because you start to see your breath and things start to freeze around you. I thought that was a really neat effect in the game. The concept of this was actually popularized by author and mythologist Jacob Grimm, who we've already mentioned, in 1835. In his version of the story, he mixed folklore with textual evidence from medieval up to early modern period. He believed the myth to have pre-Christian roots, and that its leader was allegedly, he said, on legends of Odin. I was waiting for this tie-in on the darker aspects of Odin's character. But he also thought the leader of the hunt could have been a woman, perhaps a heathen goddess named Brigtha or Holda. He believed the female may also have been Odin's wife. The hunt was said to pass through the forest in the coldest, stormiest times of the year. Anyone found outdoors at the time would be swept up into the hunting party involuntarily and dropped miles from their original location. That sounds like the dropping of the unborn souls, right? Maybe it was just people that got sucked up into it like you might in a tornado and spit out. And they're like, ah! It might be scary to have people falling on your head, screaming people. Sure, that would freak me out. Practitioners of magic may have sought to, be berserkers in spirit with their bodies safely at home. So like astral projection, I guess. Grimm, of course, also said that the story inevitably changed from pre-Christian to more modern time. A hunt led by a god and goddess visiting the land during a holy holiday, bringing blessings and accepting offerings from people. They could be heard by the people in the howling winds, but later became known as a pack of ghouls with malicious intent. Numerous variations of a legend mention different leaders of the hunting party. In Germany, the leader is, of course, known by various names. For instance, Holt, Hall, there's the beautiful goddess, Holly, Bertha, Faust, or Him. Yet one figure frequently appears in the majority of the versions, Odin, or Wodan. Odin is known by two particular names which relate to the time of year the wild hunt is alleged to occur, Jölner and Jölhera. Both of these roughly mean Master of Yule, a festival celebrating the change of seasons. Legend of the hunt has been adapted over the years, and depending also on the geographical location, the leader of the hunt along with it. In the Middle Ages, with heathen deities becoming a thing of the past, the hero of the story became characters such as Charlemagne, King Arthur, Frederick Barbarossa, who was the Holy Roman Emperor in the 12th century, and not the pirate, although that would have been cool. In the 16th century, Hans von Hackenberg was said to lead the wild hunt. The story recounts him slaying a boar, accidentally piercing his foot on the boar's tusk, and poisoning himself. Oh, kudos, kudos. Everyone applaud. The wound was fatal, and upon his death, von Hackelberg declared he didn't want to go to heaven, but instead continue with his treasured avocation, hunting. He was then forced to do this for an eternity in the night sky, or, as recounted in alternate versions, condemned to lead the wild hunt. And it wasn't a, you know, it wasn't a good thing. It was a punishment. Sources cite his name as possibly being a corruption of an epithet of Odin's name. In Wales, a variation of the story exists purporting the leader to be Gwyn ap Nudd, or Lord of the Dead. In this version, the Lord of the Dead is followed by a pack of hounds with blood-red ears. In England, the same white hounds with red ears appear in legends. They were called the Gabriel Hounds and said to portend doom if you saw them. Hrungnir the Hunter, or Harlthing, is alleged to be the hunt's leader in southern England and possibly connected to the mythical king Hurla. In the Orkney Island tradition, they speak of fairies or ghosts coming out at night and galloping on white horses. In northern France, Mesni d'Elkin, the goddess of death, was said to lead the ghostly procession. It's all over the place, y'all. Now, clerics in 12th century Britain reportedly witnessed a wild hunt. They claimed there were 20 to 30 hunters in the party, and the hunt continued for 9 weeks. The earlier reports available of the wild hunt generally represented the participants as diabolical, whereas in later medieval retellings, the hunters became fairies instead. I must pause here in reading their account. Fairies may or may not be accurately described as diabolical, but that sentence almost reads to me as if they're saying, oh, and then they just became fairies. Original folklore and tales of fairies, as are the fair folk, if you will, especially in Celtic lands, they are not cute little winged. That's a Victorian watered down version of them, my friends. And people who listen to me on the regular probably know that. Maybe you don't. Now you do. I just have to take exception to that particular sentence. They might not mean it that way, but it comes across to me as you're saying, oh, it's no big deal, they're just little fairies. No, 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 no. Now, the legend, some believe, may be related to the Dandy Dogs. I don't know what this is. Let's find out, shall we, together. In the tale, Dando wanted a drink of water, cursed his huntsman for not having any, and was then offered water by a stranger. The stranger then stole Dando's game, and Dando himself caused his dogs to give chase. Or did it? Wait. They stole Dando and Dando? Okay. Another version focuses on King Hurla, who had just visited the Fairy King. The king was told not to dismount his horse until the greyhound he carried had jumped down first. 3 centuries passed, and his men continued to ride as the dog had not jumped down yet. In Germany, the hunter is sometimes associated with a devil or dragon and rides a horse accompanied by numerous hounds. The prey, if mentioned, is usually a young woman who is either innocent or guilty of some crime. Now, heads or tails, pick one. Often the tale recounts someone encountering the hunt. If they oppose or stand up to the evil horde, they, of course, are punished. But if they help them, they are rewarded, usually with money or a leg of a slain animal, you know, food. Unfortunately, if they receive the latter, it's usually cursed and impossible to get rid of without the aid of a magician or priest. You got a haunted piece of meat there, yo. Sorry. I was trying to be nice, but I forgot we're this cursed horde. Yeah. Tales also mention that someone standing in the middle of the road is somehow safe. Well, tell us why, damn it. Anyway, the wild hunt was not seen, only heard, in Scandinavian versions of the myth. Typically, the barking of Odin's dogs, as well as the forest growing deathly silent, warned people of their imminent arrival. The hunt commonly signified a change in seasons or the onset of war in Scandinavian folklore. In Scotland, the wild hunt is closely linked to the fairy world in some sources. Evil fairies were said to be cast from the slua, or unseelie court, which is the noble fairy court. The Slua allegedly flew from the west in order to capture dying souls, resulting in people in Scotland up until the 20th century even closing windows and doors on the west side of their houses when they had a sick person inside. Similarly, the Orkney Islands were said to be home to trolls or trolls. The creatures supposedly hated the sunlight and tried to catch and eat mortals unless the humans were lucky enough to escape by crossing over a stream. Now we're going to move to modern paganism. In modern tradition, practitioners incorporate the concept of the wild hunt in their rituals. In the late 1990s, anthropologist Susan Greenwood witnessed such a ritual. So they say. She reported the pagans used the myth in order to lose themselves, as well as confront and restore harmony with the wild, dark side of nature. According to the Handbook of Contemporary Paganism, the hunt embraces the participation with souls, the dead, and animals, as well as the ritualized circle of life and death. Folklore sought to bring understanding to what was unexplainable at the time, often through the personification of concepts. In today's world, we have science and technology to demystify any concepts which haven't been categorized, blah, 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 blah. Thankfully, we have not unlocked every puzzle in the universe, and with recent technological advancements, we may yet go where no man has gone before. That's how they ended it, all right? Yeah, I think it's a bummer to take away all of the good folklore. Since I brought up the Mariluid, I want to look up a little something like that because I think it's very related. So this, the first thing I click on, hyperallergic.com. The skeletal Welsh horse you must beat in a battle of rhymes. So this is by Alice and Mir from December 19, 2016. In the Welsh folkloric tradition of the Mariluid, a horse skull visits your home around Christmas and you must best it in poetry or allow it inside. Well, that sounds nice. There's a skeletal horse singing rhymes outside your door and it wants to come inside. Can you beat the dead mare in a battle of poetic wits? This is the Welsh tradition of the Mariluid, a midwinter custom wherein the skull of a horse, decked out with bells and ribbons, is paraded on a stick by a reveler beneath a sackcloth who challenges neighbors in exchange for drink and food. It probably goes without saying that although Mariluid now manifests around Christmas and New Year's, this is a pre-Christian practice, one of those pagan rituals that's endured on the British Isles over the centuries. The rather terrifying spectacle of Mariluid did nearly disappear from Wales at one point, yet it's had a resurgence recently, with Christmas ornaments being used for eyes occasionally instead of old glass bottle bottoms. The insults in the Punko battles, as they're called, are milder these days, and the drinking is a little less heavy, so she says, but the sardonic grin of the horse skull, sometimes with a spring-loaded jaw, remains to haunt your Yuletides. There's a 1966 video from BBC Wales. I will link this page because the video is here. The Mariluid dialogue plays out in matching rhymes until the undead mare is let in. Oh my God! Maybe we can just play it and you can hear the sound. Now this one, they have a person. It's not just on a stick. There's a person walking in a sheet. Do you hear the bells?
Well, the morning, the wild goblets yawned, the new world, the Ovinamgenan, the Ovinamgenan, the Ovinamgenan, the Gani. Os noch awn i genad roch rawad, a gonyad, a bod moer ma dawnyad, Pobod mair ma dawiad, pobod mair ma dawiad, no sy'n mwyn. Mae'r fari lwyd ymlaen o'n sy'n zar yn gona, mae'n werth i roi gola, mae'n werth i roi gola, mae'n werth i roi gola i wylen.
That's the horse. The bells are the horse, I should say. That That's the person inside the house.
Ma bechgyn a fari yng gysi a canu yn well na bin crosbi na hyn rhyw yn ianci sydd ar y teledur nos enw. Mi glywai sieddi ta fasys da bolsi a ddoiog yn tedi sydd gadan i fati a gwirad yw anni. Ma bechgyn y fari yn dilyn Cair ardyn a'i bifan a hatlu Ac os oed i'n dori Bydd rhaid i ti rannu'r nos enw Mae Wilson yn gweddi bo' eisiau Ni wysgu a ffaidio gwas troffi Nes gallu di dalu am glywai chi'n canu'r nos enw. Mae Seth a Defrisian yn mynd i Sanharan, fydd doi bab ar wygan, fawr bwlch yn yr hyrian, sy'n dod o Thames Ditan yn syrru. Mae'n well bod ti'n cewi ac yn rhoi di fannu'r ac ofnet i syffu a sychwen a ddeulu a lachwen a ddeulu noes yn o. Os wyt ti yn credu mod hi mynd i syffu ffoli na byw hynny Mae'n wedyn cynnesu pan ysbryd i'n berwyr yn os yn o.
Wel, ydy'n orwodd o wag i fi wir. Diolch mewn, boys.
That's, come in, boys. He finally opened the door and let him in, so I guess they won.
Mae hyn yn un arferiad gyda ni yn Llangynod. Mynd o gylch y ffermydd.
And this is one man still standing outside talking to the pen
ceffil,
video person.
Wedi ei ddurno gyda sir a ribana a mae yn hen arferiad a'r cynta glwas i sôn amdano oedd ewerth i mi yn dweud fod yn byw yn llwy'n braen yn ogyn ac yn cofio'r fari lwyd yn dod yn gros i gaia Bryn Llwarch a mae yna dros gan mlynedd yn ôl. A mae'r ein arferiad yn para o hyd. A chi glwswch ni'n canu'r ein benithion, ni dorson ein crimpa wrth groesi'r stichilia wrth ddyfod siag yma i ganu. Ond mae'r fari lwyd fel llawer o bethau heris yn moderneiddio ac yn y dyfodol tebyg iawn taw mewn rhyw gar neu jeep byddan nhw'n mynd allan o gylch y ffermyn. Well, yeah, we may not the cumly.
And then he goes into the house. I will, like I said, I will share this link. I do not speak Cymru, which is the Welsh language, but I think it's just beautiful sounding, and you might recognize there's some familiarity with, say, Elvish and Lord of the Rings, Tolkien pulled from many sources. But it's beautiful to listen to, I think. That whole thing was in Cymru, so if anyone out there speaks it, I hope that you enjoyed that, and I think I stopped for a minute to see, I'm looking at my Audacity is what I use, and looking at the spikes, you know, I can see that it should have been picking it up. Hopefully that came out well. There are some other very good photographs on this site as well. I want to then go to, I see a part here I'm going to skip to. Welsh poet Vernon Watkins paid tribute to his nation's custom in 1941. The Ballad of the Maerlwyd. The manuscript itself is annotated by T.S. Eliot at the British Library, apparently, but it does begin, Maerlwyd, horse of frost, star horse, and white horse of the sea, is carried to us. The dead return. Those exiles carry her, they who seem holy and have put on corruption, they who seem corrupt and have put on holiness. They strain against the door, they strain towards the fire which fosters and warms the living. It's also had some influence on the visual arts. In 1998, late painter William Brown portrayed Marie-Louise as an animated creature with human feet, while Clive Hicks Jenkins explored the character in a series of narrative illustrations. There's even a mural in tribute in Cardiff by the street artist Flem. Yes, that's correct, Flem. The day on which Marie-Louise roams varies from town to town, so keep an eye out and a sharp wit for when the mayor comes around. Better get those rhymes going, boys and girls. Get those rhymes going. I think I've covered pretty much what I wanted to cover. Just a fun little Christmas type episode. I think more than anything, I wanted to give equal credit to the feminine side of the Krampus tales, right? In fact, the Frau probably, from everything I looked at, predates Krampus. I'm not saying anybody stole from anyone, by the way. Don't take that the wrong way. I'm just saying, Krampus is popular. I say we need to make Frau Perchta popular, or put them together and they can maybe they'll be less cranky. If we could just play matchmaker here and they could go through the night sky together. And based on one of the things that I looked up here, where some of the tales do say that there was a pair, right? A man and a woman on the wild hunt. Maybe they just need to be reunited. Reunited and it fit. No, sorry, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to listen to this and see how bad it is. And then if it ends up really short when I cut out all the bad parts, maybe I'll add something new. All right, I came back. Not because it was horribly short, but I remembered I didn't want to leave out the little gnome-looking creatures, one of which is called a tomta. And you've seen them. You might even have them as decorations. They almost look like yard gnomes, but cuter. So I am reading from the Swedish press. If you have ever visited a Swede's house in December, it's very likely you come across a stuffed gnome-like figure with a woolly beard and a conical cap cheerfully perched upon the fireplace or on the dining room table. These little men, alongside Sweden's quintessential straw goats, or julbakar, are integral to Scandinavian folklore and tradition. While many know and recognize these classic decorations, not all appreciate the far-reaching history of the tomte. Tomte, derived from the Swedish word tomt, or plot of land, literally means homestead man. If you've ever heard the beloved character referred to as Nisse, it is likely in reference to a Norwegian variant of the mythological figure, as Nisse is a Norwegian nickname for the name Nils. Typically depicted as a small and elderly man, the tomte is roughly half the size of a man with rags for clothes and a heavy white beard. This miniature sprite has long been a symbol for the winter solstice and the celebration of Yuletide, though his connotations have evolved over the years. Originally, the homestead man was believed to be the ancestral spirit of the first farmer to have worked on a given plot of land. Dwelling around the farm, but careful to always remain out of sight, the tomte is known to be a dutiful, hard worker. He cares for the animals, children, and property at the homestead, asking very little in return, but respect and the occasional bowl of porridge. The Frau also likes porridge. At the inkling of disrespect, which can come in the form of foul language or a sudden change in an age-old tradition, he will not hesitate to stir up trouble. Tomtas are known to be mischievous and fiery-tempered, acting out through something as benign as mixing up the animals in the barn to much more extreme shows of chaos and violence. A classic example of this fickle character is the story of Tomte and his Christmas porridge. For his loyal work throughout the year, a tomte is said to require a bowl of porridge with a generous dollop of butter on the top when the holidays come around. Legend has it that one year a servant girl jokingly hid the butter at the bottom of the bowl, and the Tomte was so infuriated by the slight that he slaughtered the family's best cow. Upon finishing his meal and realizing that there was butter at the bottom of the bowl, well, the Tomte felt guilty. So guilty that he stole a neighbor's cow as a replacement to atone for his mistake. While many viewed the prospect of having a Tomte as a blessing of good fortune, earlier believers associated the character with false gods and devil worship. The Tomte was considered heathen. To keep one indicated not only laziness, but also opposed a potential threat to neighboring farmers, as the sprite was known to steal. In a 14th century decree, the famous Saint Birgitta of Vadstena warned against Tomte Gudi, or Tomte gods, perpetuating the idea that these creatures put one's soul at risk. Today, however, the Tomte is aligned more closely with the jolly Saint Nicholas than with his pagan roots. Aside from their shared name and a few costume similarities, it is very clear that the homestead Tomte and the American Santa Claus, with his jolly belly and hearty laugh, don't actually have much in common. How then did they become interlinked? Tommy Kusella from the Swedish Institute for Language and Folklore argues that it was through artists and authors that the Tomte's name and image shifted over time. One significant factor in the evolution of Tomte comes from artist Jenny Nystrom's interpretation of Victor Rydberg's poem Tomten. First published in New Illustrated Magazine in 1881, Rydberg paints a picture of the Tomte's solitary life. Midwinter's nightly frost is hard, brightly the stars are beaming. Fast asleep is the lonely yard, all at midnight are dreaming. Clear is the moon and the snowdrifts shine, glistening white on fir and pine. Covers on rooflets making, none but the Tomte is waking. Nystrom's accompanying illustration offers a new kind of Tomte, a mix between Tomte, Santa, and a Yule goat, who traditionally delivered presents to children in Swedish folklore. That resulted in a shift of the persona. He became an adult-sized man, friendly, carrying a bag of gifts on his back, often with his Yule goat in tow. While the original Tomte has not died out, he is much less frequently referred to than his newer model. Kusella points out that this is a reaction not only to the international Tomte's commercial appeal, but also the transformation of Sweden from a nation filled with country dwellers to city dwellers. I'm going to stop there. I just wanted to share that little bit with you. I have one on my tree right now, and when I went to Julfest 2-3 weeks ago, they were selling beautiful woolen handmade Tomtes, of course. So however you want to look at them, it might be nice to have one as a little guardian in your house, and don't forget the porridge. And also this year, my friends, don't be lazy and keep your house tidy. You wouldn't want to wake up staring down at your guts, falling all over the bed and staining your sheets. Yeah, would we? All right, now I'm done. And I'll have to go back and listen to this little part so it's not too loud. Please find me on all the socials. I deactivated my Twitter. That's all we'll say about it. But I'm still on TikTok, S_Royt. I still have my Instagrams, Pinky Swear Press, Pinky Pod, you know, with the underscores between the words. I'm on Facebook. I'm PinkySwearPress.com, my official website. And hey, y'all, I finished a while back the omnibus. If you're into vampires, male-male romance, it's a 5-book series that is finished, but I redid it. They started coming out in 2008. I redid the whole thing by hand, retyped it, etc. So yes, the giant-sized paperback is $35 and will be for the foreseeable future because that shit was hard. All right, it was tedious to redo it. Just the typing. Would make a good Christmas gift for somebody who's into that. And hey, you don't have to worry about a series not being finished because it's all there. Or you can get the Kindle, 1,626 pages, my friends, for $9.99. Paris Immortal, the Eternal Edition. Thank you for listening. Happy holidays. And I will probably see you or hear you next year. Thanks for listening. Pa-pow. Remember the porridge. Remember the porridge. And put the butter on top.